In the emotion, the systemic changes kind of just die down. It just
Yes,
the attention is
exactly.
not
They're
on them.
riled up
So
with
we're just
emotion.
talking about who's angry and why they're angry, and but we're not talking about what needs to change in the system.
Right, right.
You talked about the hypocrisy, and this is a great segue into the next conversation I want to have with you. I want to talk about the promise of America. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. The American dream, our ideals, that are deeply flawed and frankly lies, even though so many of us believe in it. What do people need to understand to realize the truth about America?
I think the truth about America is something that people understand on an instinctive and instinctual level, but are not perhaps willing to articulate out loud, which is that this is a country built on genocide and slavery. And when you have a nation that's built on those, you also have a country that has to constantly be self-aware of how the world that you build required and continues to require the exploitation and annihilation of people. And I think, I don't know what, you're asking what is the promise of America? I mean, so your question is, what needs to change, or?
My question is just like, what do people need to sort of understand, right? Like, we talked a lot about the hypocrisy. We talked a lot about, we're talking about feelings, but the real issues are kind of just under the surface, buried constantly to benefit, a few folks. Like, we talked about Bezos owns Washington Post. That is problematic, not the fact that he
Right.
nixed the endorsement.
Systems. I think
Right.
if I were told go out, go forth, and develop a new way of thinking about the world, not just for Americans, but for others, I would say systems. We have to start thinking systemically, and we have to start thinking about what are the systems that are grinding us down, as opposed to what are the emotions that we need to feel. And I think there's a lot of emphasis on things like happiness and contentment, and those are the goals, but those are not the goals. The goals should be, you might be miserable, but do you have what you need? I think what I find more worthwhile pursuing is a world where people have what they need, as opposed to people feeling certain ways. So I have no interest in whether or not people are happy, because I don't know what makes people happy. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you might be someone who's happy, killing a baby seal every month. I don't know what makes you happy. I'm sorry to bring that up. Trigger warning. I don't know what makes you happy. Maybe what makes you happy is, making your daughter very unhappy. What makes people happy is not a question I ever want to answer, but I think the problem is that that is implicitly, I think, what we base a lot of our political work upon, which is what can make people happy. And I think the issue has to be, what do people need in this world, and how do we get it to them? This is what I've written about constantly, which is, what do people need? And Howard Zinn had something similar as well, right? Where he said, what is it that people need, and how do we get it to them? And that's all I ever really ask, which is, what do people need? How do we get it to them? As opposed to, who are people, and are they deserving of food and housing? I don't care if they're deserving. I don't know what that means. I just know that someone needs it. So fundamentally, we have to shift how we think about everyone else can and should survive. And the question cannot be, what is the force of their character? The question has to be, what the fuck do they need? How do we get it to them? And I think that's the basic question that no one wants to ask. And if you were to ask that question, then you would have to confront matters like the economic issues that are forcing migrants across borders, or questions around what
Homelessness.
housing. Yeah, homelessness. What do people need and how do we get it to them? I think that's really the only question that I want us to be both concerned with. But that's not what I see happening. I constantly see this constant move, which is again, so for instance, the left right now around immigration is all about if Trump does X, we're all going to show up. And I think that works, yes. But it only, those are stopgap measures. And it does matter. So, for instance, recently in Chicago, there was a proposal to get rid of a measure that would disallow police, local police officers from colluding with ICE. And there was a move to, to remove that. And a lot of people showed up at City Hall and they were able to defeat that amendment, et cetera. So, yes, in those cases, that sort of thing does matter. But, with the travel ban, Muslim travel ban, for instance, early 2021, and everyone showed up at the airports. And I thought, this is great. Of course, this is important, but are you going to be able to do that every single day? And what is your solution for a long-term radical change? What is your proposal for that? No one had any. And so it's going to happen again.
And in a better way, because now he's more prepared.
He's much more prepared. He has a whole wall of lawyers.
Slew of people advising him on how to do this properly.
And these are all people who've been waiting for the last 4 years and have been, have really been sharpening their skills. So it's terrifying. But the left is responsible for that. It's not the right that is responsible, because I look at the left and I think, okay, fine, you can say that his policies are heinous and abusive and all of that, but what did you ever have in response other than we're going to show up and fight back? I've always written, I said, well, you and whose army?
It's a very interesting, when you kind of start peering into this a little bit, you realize you talked about donors earlier, right? And the donors will stop, right? If these solutions are so, if these problems are solved. And then what are the wealthy people who depend on these jobs and make all those money? Where are they going to go? Right? So it almost like everything comes down to power and money.
ICIRR, for instance, exists only because there's constant crises. There are constant crises around immigration. And if those crises were to stop, ICIRR would have to go out of business. What would it be left to do? File paperwork, perhaps, for maybe 10 more years. If, for instance, Trump even said, okay, I'm going to fix immigration once and for all, here are the ways in which I'm going to actually provide people a pathway to citizenship. And here are the ways I'm going to allow for amnesty for these kinds of people, et cetera. If Trump came out and did that, ICIRR, for instance, would just die. They would be so furious. And because what else do they survive on is this constant anxiety and constant sense of crisis. And that has been true for the immigration rights movement as a whole for a very long time.
And if it's applicable to them, it's applicable to perhaps the other issues as well that we as a society need to really look
I mean,
at.
think about abortion. If abortion is not a question of bodily autonomy, it's an economic issue. It is about people not being able to engage in the world because they were forced to carry a fetus to term, is to raise a child with that they didn't want to step out of the job market. So this happens to a lot of women where childbirth and having children means losing out on economic opportunities, whether you're a waitress or whether you're a professor. Your ability to earn is significantly dramatically reduced if you have to raise children without sufficient resources. We know this. But what does Planned Parenthood talk about? Bodily autonomy and women's right to choose. It's not about that. It's about it affecting everyone, including the male children of women forced to carry, right? Of women forced to give birth to children. And there are, I want to say, there are abortion rights organizations that are trying to do different kinds of work. But Planned Parenthood is still the one that has the most power to determine the conversation. And that's where a lot of even lefties, lefties talk about diversity, are now sneering about diversity and identity. It's very interesting to me because they don't talk about women as an identity, right? Because they don't want to get white women angry at them. But woman is an identity. And if you think about that, then what do you say about your refusal to think about abortion on economic terms? Okay. So anyway.
It's almost like present an argument that has no scope of winning, and then
Right.
we can continue the issue
Right.
forever,
Right.
right? Because
Right.
if you talked about it from an economic perspective, it probably would register a little bit further. I mean, I have no way of knowing, but common sense, I guess, tying it back to the kitchen table would probably have a little more consequence opposed to talking about bodily autonomy and the right to control my own body. Important, but maybe harder to perceive. So I just want to kind of, we talked about a lot of different things, and just to kind of summarize our conversation, if I may, we've talked about, a little bit about genocide, we've talked about the billionaire class, we've talked about the inability of politicians to get things done. Basically, they're in for themselves in terms of money, power, prestige, however you call it. And all of this eventually leads to degradation for common people and our lives, right? They're reduced to the whims of all of these sort of machinations of the world. And you talked a little bit about systems need to change, but how do we do that? Because it's one of the things that we constantly talk about is show up and protest and stuff. And yes, to a certain degree, that does hold power. But what else do we need to do? And how do we get there in terms of, a nation and humanity? Like, it's not all doom and gloom. You know what I mean? Like, how do we sort of change this for the better? I realize it's a big question.
No, it's a good question. And yes, I mean, there is, I don't like the word hope, but I think there are possibilities for change. So for instance, the activist Mariam Kaba works on the issue of libraries. And she's a prison abolitionist who went back to school to get a library science degree. And whose activism now is focused around prisons, but also around the question of public libraries. And her whole point is that, to change things on a macro level, you have to look at things like library boards, join library boards, for instance, agitate, not just against quote unquote book bans, but what all of that means in a larger context. So I think what people can and sh if they have the time and the resources, should do is to think about things like school boards, right? Joining school boards or joining local activist organizations, working with your public library, for instance, joining the board of your public library, et cetera. So those are the things, I think those are tangible ways in which people can make changes. But my concern is also about resources, emotional and material resources. What do people have? I mean, to be frank with you, I'm not feeling a tremendous amount of hope, to be perfectly frank with you, because I am part of a quote unquote radical leftist world. And there's a lot of amazing work being done. So, for instance, there's, the anarchist bookstore in North Carolina, the name of which I'm forgetting. But, there are all these places that are serving as hubs of survival and places where people can recharge and be in quote unquote community with people and so on. But I don't find at the same time, there's this thing called mutual aid, but I don't find mutual aid particularly useful because it still relies on trusting quote unquote community. And I have learned the hard way to not trust community. As much as I have also learned to trust community, I've also learned that community doesn't show up for you if it doesn't like you, right? So the left has a certain kinds of means testing, which is, do we like this person enough? And that's a different kind of means testing, but it still is means testing and so on. So I'm not, I'm not I think what needs, I'm not completely hopeful, but I think what needs to change is for me on the left. I'm not really concerned with attacking conservatives because I think that just takes up so much energy and time. And I think it's a lot of performative energy as well spent on all of that. People, you know, liberals especially love to bash Trump, call him names, and so on. And I always look at that and think, okay, you wouldn't fat shame anyone else, but you are okay. You know, we could go on about that. But anyway, the point being, I'm not particularly hopeful about the left. And I, you know, rather than say, oh, I have hope on this front, I actually think it's important for us to maintain a level of critique and, frankly, even cynicism. I'm very tired of a left that keeps wanting to act via affect and emotion. I feel like the left has degenerated into a place where people are allowed to feel rather than make change on a systemic level. So I'm, you know, so for instance, okay, let's think about labor. Yes, I will agree that one of the most successful parts of the left has been around labor organizing. We're seeing more unions, whether it's graduate unions or whether it's unions at, you know, Starbucks and Amazon. And I think, yes, that's great. But within that discourse and within that activism is, I find, increasingly a solidification of the worker in very affective terms. So, following this election in particular, we're seeing a lot of discourse around workers. We're all workers and laborers. And it's a very romanticized idea of the worker. And it's an ideal that doesn't really exist anymore, right? Look, and they're also looking at, oh, the worker as this sort of 1950s figure, often white, often male, who goes home, back home to a wife who's cooked his dinner and his 2.5 children and so on and manufacture. So what is fascinating to me about the US in terms of the labor movement is how it's coalescing around the worker in these very anachronistic ways. So I don't find that useful. And now there is this discourse around diversity and identity, this sort of supposed critique of identity. And the argument is being made over and over again on the left now that if we're going to talk about workers, we can't also talk about identity. When in fact, you know, a black worker faces very different circumstances from a white worker. You can't, as my friend and colleague Lily Sanchez at Current Affairs says, you can't dismiss race as an issue if you don't get rid of the racism as well. And how are you going to do that, right? So, you know, so I think that we have to find on the left a way to think about questions around labor and identity, and yes, diversity, the necessity for all of that, without returning to very anachronistic ways of thinking about worker issues, labor issues, what the left should stand for. And I'm very disturbed by the left's anachronism, its constant drive towards an older form of worker movements, for instance. You know, Marxists, for instance, in my experience, one of the reasons I stopped identifying as a Marxist is because I find that Marxists have no idea how money works. That's been my experience. You guys have no idea how money works. You've read your Marx and you keep saying, you know, means of production every time someone brings something up. And you can quote Marx like nobody else can, but you don't know how money works. And that's why you're always taken by surprise when economies shatter, right? So, and that's a longer conversation, but you know, it's a very broad statement, I realized, but I'm rambling right now, but bring me back because I think what this is making me think about is the fact that I'm not particularly hopeful. because I don't really have a lot of faith in the left. I have faith in a leftist agenda, but I'm not seeing on the left a real commitment to thinking expansively about what people need and how we can get it to them. And I'm very, very tired of the narratives that the left seems to be enmeshed in. I'm going to stop here because I'm not going to stop the interview, but I'm just rambling right now.
No, I agree with you. I think there is a lot. I talk to a lot of folks, and usually everybody says, "Hey, I feel hopeful and I feel good, and we need to make the change." And somehow that their hope doesn't translate to me, because I don't feel hopeful about everything. I mean, let's just look at something as simple as climate change right now, and all of LA burning and people still refusing to even do the bare minimum. And then there are those who are fighting and completely being ignored. I also think that fighting with the left is a better, not fighting, but sort of working to dismantle some of the systems within left is better than doing it to the right. But I also feel like they've given up so much in terms of identity and in terms of sort of ethos that they had. Talking, people say, "Oh, Biden was the best president since FDR." And I'm like, which world are you living in? He's given so many concessions to so many people. He's worked for his wealthy donors the whole time. The man, probably has some kind of an illness going on, and nobody told us about it. Man can't keep his eyes open anywhere. I mean, I on what basis do you kind of make these statements? It's really unbelievable for me. And I almost look at the left in some ways like they have moved, they keep moving to the right,
Yes,
right?
exactly. Exactly.
And they have made so many concessions to get like this, oh my God, this voter who is imagined voter, who's never going to vote for them, the Republican moderate, right? And they have pushed themselves so far to the right now that they've kind of almost lost their way. And ideologically, they can't define themselves any differently. So when you listen to a Democrat talking, 9 times out of 10, they sound like a Republican.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the left, and even people on the quote unquote left are increasingly sounding like that, I think, so the two issues that I plan to write on and think about a lot more in the coming months and years, as we confront the next 4 years, are the two issues are immigration and abortion. And on both, it is the left that has failed us. It is not the right. The right is just doing what we could always expect. The right has been consistently anti-abortion since the beginning of time. Why are we even arguing about this, right? But the left is the reason why we are where we are with abortion. We're still going on about Roe v. Wade. Well, Roe was always useless. It was never what we needed anyway. What we needed was to fight and say abortion should be free and available no matter what the circumstances. That should always have been the base from which we fought. It is the left that conceded and continues to concede by now resorting to things like storytelling. I was looking at the agenda for the last what is it the Was the socialist conference? Yes, I think it was a socialist conference for the last couple of years. And on abortion, all they can do is share stories, share stories. I'm like, what is sharing a story? Of course, abortion is painful. Of course, it's terrible if a woman is denied an abortion, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it's awful when she is forced to go through a miscarriage. And, what point have these stories, what has been the use of these stories, right? So think about it economically, think about it as a question of economic autonomy, not bodily autonomy. Immigration, it is the left that dropped the ball. What is the left agenda on immigration other than show up and fight? No, there is no agenda. So those are the two issues I'm going to keep talking about. And I think, to be honest with you, I feel the need to move through, I think, what I described in a longer piece about as pessimism, right? Necessary pessimism. And to understand, I don't know what we're working towards. I honestly am, I'm sort of beginning to despair. That has something to do perhaps with very particular, my own very particular circumstances. But I'm just tired of optimism. I'm tired of being told to be in community. I'm tired of, all of this bullshit on the left about community and common cause. And when at the same time, people like me have been constantly shut down, for instance, on immigration. So to give you an example, okay, I'll give you an example here, which is when DACA was first brought up, which is deferral of childhood, arrivals. A lot of us on the radical left of immigration rights kept saying this is not a good idea because, first of all, it's only an executive order and it can be removed by the next president. It is not a great, it is, and it's going to push people out of the shadows and it's going to force them to expose themselves to the system, right? So we kept saying DACA is not a good idea. And we were consistently shut down on that. And now look what has happened. Everyone who came out is now out in public. And also, all of them have now aged out, and DACA is now closed, right? There are people who were in their 20s years ago and who thought that DACA would change their lives. They're now in their 30s and they're still struggling. And they've now come out as undocumented in a time of Trump.
So now
So,
they're in trouble.
yeah, and now they're in
Yeah,
trouble.
right.
And what have you done for those people? But there are a few people among the DACA crowd who have gained, higher level administrative jobs, perhaps. But even they are not, for instance, able to travel freely. All of they still have the same issues. So this is why I'm kind of pessimistic about the left, because, and again, it's the same as with abortion. Look what happened. We lost even the most ridiculously useless bit, Roe v. Wade. We lost Roe. So what was the point of all of that? We lost it.
It's the abortion thing gets me so angry because there were so many opportunities to codify it. And the left didn't do it, right? You had super majorities since going back to Carter. And I distinctly remember when Obama said that this was a priority for him. And then he came into office and completely flipped the script on it. And then Pelosi goes, it's going to cost us to keep focusing on this. And to be perfectly frank with you, I think the left was, it was a talking point for them. It was something that could help them with elections. But the moment it started affecting white women in particular is when they kind of started to say, oh, we need to get serious about this. But as you very well know, communities of color have been affected by this going back decades. There has never been a fix.
No. And the women who most suffer from, the prevalence of abortion bans, or even the fact that abortion is simply not even easily available, even in a city like Chicago, the women who suffer the most are poor women, poor white women, and poor Black women for the most part, right? Those are the people who will suffer the most. I live in Chicago, and if I needed an abortion tomorrow, A, I would have to friggin' fundraise because it's $250 or $300. I would have to fundraise, and then I would have to find a friend to drive me because there isn't one nearby. It's in a somewhat inaccessible place. And I live in Chicago. It's a blue city for the most, well, kind of blue, purplish city. So, and yeah, as we all know, and but I think we need to keep repeating that a woman who lives in, say, for instance, a rural area or a town will sometimes have to lose her job just to go get an abortion because there are all those issues around, having to wait for 24 hours and come back, etc. So women often are faced with losing a job. to get an abortion.
Again, making it an economic issue.
Yeah, exactly. It's an economic issue. Abortion is an economic issue. It is nothing else. It is an economic issue. I'm sorry, it's not about bodily autonomy. It's about economic autonomy. And as long as it doesn't, people like Nancy Pelosi and Meryl Streep and all these women who show up at the protest, none of them are ever going to be affected. If they need an abortion, they just go to their private healthcare providers. And that, again, is the big distinction, right, in this country between who can afford private means, as for instance, in the California fires, who can afford to have private firefighters show up, and who can afford to go to a private doctor for a private abortion. That is the big distinction.
Yes, it is. It is.
I mean, I feel like for years I tried, along with many others, to get people. Sorry, by the way, I hope my voice is. I keep moving away from the mic, and I apologize if it changes the volume. But yeah, I'm just thinking back to the question of immigration, and how hard some of us were trying in Chicago to change the conversation, and how much we were mocked, even by, for instance, a certain writer, for instance, for The Nation, who w they were all so fixated on their friends who were these undocu queers and these sad, good-looking, educated young people, while the rest of us were saying, we still have to think about labor. We still have to think about the workers who are undocumented. And we were shut down on that, So I think some of this is also, to be perfectly frank with you, I think a lot of this is also reflective of my sense that I have, like many others, been trying to change conversations and actions, for instance, around immigration. And I had begun that in sometime around the aughts, and it's now 25 years later, and we are worse off. And I can recall the tremendous amount of effort a lot of us put into trying to change the conversation, and how it was just shut down, not by the right, but by the left. So that's, I think, where my pessimism and cynicism come from. So, I apologize to listeners that no, I don't have any, I don't have hope for you. What I do have is a dark, cynical assertion that if we don't fucking start thinking about this differently, we are all very, very fucked.
I think a healthy dose of cynicism here is warranted almost.
Yes, I mean, you and I are talking about this on the 17th, is it? So there are 3 days left
Yes.
to Trump's inauguration. What the fuck do we have to be hopeful about right now?
And I mean, he has said he's not waiting until the 21st. He's going to start doing things on the 20th. As he's taking the oath of office, people are going into their offices and they're going to start working. So they are ready and they're armed with their agenda. So there is a lot of bitter and difficult times ahead of us. There is absolutely no question about that.
What is it that Sarah Palin said? How is that hopey thing going? Hopey, faithy thing going?
There we go. I mean, they're not wrong.
It's right. What's, yeah. How's that hopey thing going for you? I mean, I think that the way to go about things now is for the left to finally realize that we have to be more cynical, we have to be darker, we have to stop thinking about narratives of affect and goodness and light and all of that, and understand that we have to formulate a different agenda for ourselves and not in reaction to the right. I think this is also the big failure of the left in the US. It has always worked in response to the right. and it doesn't know how to work otherwise. So the question for me for the left is, take the right out of the picture. Take Trump out of the picture. Now tell me, how are you going to change things on abortion? How are you going to change things on immigration? Just those two issues, even. Just tell me, how do you change things? And do it without constructing figures of sympathetic figures and so on. Tell me what your legislative agenda is. And the answer is nothing so far.
Do it without sad figures. And I would also add to that, do it without a constant look back to history, which is
Yes.
not told the current and the right way. Don't twist it around to tell your story. Tell the real story, right? So I'll just say this. Cory Booker is my senator. I'm in Jersey. And the man can speak well, but I mean the spin that he can do, right?
Yes.
Absolutely ineffective, senator.
AOC
I mean, come on,
Jersey, eh?
right? It just
Oh, he is so full of bullshit. Yes.
so full of it, right? But the way he spins it, and I'm like, there was a time when I would be like, oh my God, he's so good. And now I look at him and I turn off the TV. I cannot listen to this man. Because again, the emotions and oh, the pride I felt and oh, my heart. Unfortunately, your heart filled with pride isn't going to change anything for somebody who's been starving for a week. So let's focus on the real issue here.
And then, if I may, we also have to talk about COVID, which no
That
one,
is a big, big one.
the left has completely ignored it, acts like it's over. It has never been over. And COVID is worse. And we're now faced with bird flu, which is ha wreaking havoc on animal populations and will soon has already migrated into the human population. I just read this morning about a seal and a rare bird. I forget what the rare bird was at Lincoln Zoo, no, Brookfield Zoo, I think, having died from bird flu. And but this is, as we know, bird flu is just now becoming endemic.
And it's found in waste, right? We've
Yes,
already
exactly.
found it in waste, right?
Exactly. So that's a danger. But we have pretended that COVID was over sometime in what, 2021 or something, when it was
Right
never.
after Biden came, it went away magically.
It went away magically. The other thing I remember about COVID, and this is also linked to immigration, is when COVID first, quote unquote, began, as it were, March 2020, I was walking around Chicago, which is a city filled with, as you know, migrants from all over the world. And I'm on the south side of Chicago. There was not a single PSA that was not in English. A lot of undocumented people were terrified about the vaccines when they finally came out because they were afraid that because of the way the forms were printed out. It seemed like they would perhaps be reported if they put down the information. So they were, and then, so then they redid the forms to say, no, we're not going to release your information to any authorities. And it was all again in English. So I thought, what is the point? There's the issue of under Biden, free vaccinations are no longer available. So
Even the
people,
tests are no longer free. You
tests are
have
no
to buy
longer
them.
free. And yeah, exactly, because I tried getting new tests this last week, and I was told that my household had already exceeded. And I thought, well, what if I get COVID? I haven't yet had COVID, but if I have another scare, what do I do? I only have old COVID tests because I've been stocking them up since they started sending them out. So I have about 15, 20 of these tests, and they're all expired. But I hang on to them for some reason. So there's COVID, which is also, yes, I mean, vaccines are the last defense and not the first defense. The first defense has to be masking, but we got rid of masking mandates. We got rid of free vaccinations, so the Bridge program no longer exists, which excludes a ton of people, including, may I say, this person here, this writer. I have had to borrow, from friends to get, or rather, not borrow, they kindly just gave me the money, but I've had to ask friends to help pay for my vaccines, which I haven't yet been able to get. I've stocked up the money because I cannot take time off from work. Because I don't know what the effects might be, so it might take me a couple of days to recover, et cetera. And this is true for millions of people, right? You can't just get the vaccine and hop back into work the next day because you may need time to take. So again, how is COVID not a labor issue? And why then is the left not thinking about COVID in those terms? COVID is a labor issue. Who is forced to go back? Now, I am one of those weirdly fortunate people that I don't have to get into an office. I don't have to go to a grocery store to restock the shelves, for instance. For the most part, most people are compelled, even with COVID now, they're not given days off. They have to go back to stores, restock the shelves, do their work, otherwise they get fired. So, how is COVID not a labor issue for the left? Is the big question. How is COVID not an immigration issue when undocumented people can't get vaccines, can't access healthcare, and so on, right? So, across the, COVID has just, we just act like it's done and done, as it were. And it is still a raging reality for people. People are still getting sick.
Yep, there was a rise in infections just, I believe, was it last month in December or
Oh,
so?
and every week it goes up.
Right. So it's still
And
there.
long COVID, as we know now, right? But although we refuse to acknowledge it, long COVID is getting worse. And it's now being shown to have detrimental effects on all parts of our bodies. Increases the risk of heart attacks, increases all kinds of risks now. Where's the left on COVID? Truth Out, I think, had a couple of articles. But other than that, no one else on the left, again, has also does not have the resources, right? And this is again where we come to the question of media. I once had a
Exactly.
long argument with someone on Twitter because they said, well, why isn't Current Affairs reporting on COVID? And I said, do you understand how many resources? Current Affairs is not a new, it's not a news magazine. It doesn't have the resources to send people around the country. That's what your fucking New York Times should be doing. Why don't you attack the New York Times or the Washington Post instead of coming for a small leftist magazine? Yeah, but again, resources, right? Does a place like the New York Times or the Washington Post to have, or the LA Times have the resources to have, for instance, a journalist who focuses on COVID? And yes, does it choose to do that? No. So what you have now on Twitter, for instance, and anywhere else is you have the rise of the COVID influencer instead. You have people who are talking about their personal experiences with COVID, and you're not even sure, well, is this COVID or is this something that you've had for a long time? There's no way to really analyze and contest that and so on. So you have a lot of misinformation and you have a lot of panic and paranoia. So it's a disaster. It's a complete disaster. I haven't had friends over in since 2020. I don't go out and hang out with people unless we can do it outside. And even then, I wear a mask because if I get COVID, for instance, I have no health care. So I can't get, where am I going to get Paxlovid? And
And
that becomes.
Paxlovid for people with insurance is like $1,000 or some
Exactly.
very,
So
very high copay.
all of this is a labor issue. It's an economic issue. COVID is an economic issue. It's not, but so many, even on the left, I've noticed, have been scoffing at the rest of us for even thinking about COVID. So, I mean, Rabani, I'm so sorry that I'm being so cynical and so, and not particularly optimistic, but I'm also seeing many years of a disease that is not going to go away. And It will not surprise me if Trump comes in and actually reinstitutes free vaccines and perhaps, who knows, maybe some sort of mask mandates or at least censor. It will not surprise me because I think what he might be better at than Biden is to understand how those things can work on an elemental level. So we got money, for instance, right? People got money in 2020. And it was astonishing what a change it brought to people to get, what was it, a couple of $1,000s, and to be told that, it just arrived, I mean, in your bank account. And it was brief and it was not a lot of money, but I remember people talking about how much of a difference that made to them.
Now imagine if that was a regular payment for people who,
Exactly.
right, the one time made that effect
Yes.
and it helped actually people, do some of the things that they needed to do. If that payment was consistent, it would powerfully change lives.
If you had, for instance, legislation that said, if someone has COVID, they have to be able to take, say, 2 weeks off at least. Think about the change that brings about in people's lives. Instead, what you have are people on the lowest economic rungs, right? The stock takers at grocery stores, for instance, or all the front-facing people, et cetera, forced to continue while sick without money, because otherwise they lose out on their meager pay.
Infecting others while at it,
Infecting others while at that.
unfortunately.
Yes. And there are no mask mandates, so it's just a free for all. I mean, these basic things that I have watched come about, these, when we could just have such fundamental small changes. Yes, give people money. Just
Yeah.
give people money. But again, even on the left and certainly among liberals, I always see there's disdain for that attitude. Which is, what do you mean? People don't have to work? Yeah, they don't have to work. Imagine that, a society where you don't have to work to prove your worth, or where you don't have to work when you're sick. And again, I think this is where journalism failed us during the lead up to this election, is the inability to understand how much people are struggling across this country.
I think that was the biggest missing piece. I think you hit the nail on the head. Is people just the absolute ignorance of how much people are suffering. And in some cases, maybe even the disdain,
No,
right?
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I share how you feel about this because, like I said, some of it is warranted. And I think some of it is just life experiences bringing on a sort of, element of caution into your thinking where not everything is going to be okay if we don't fix it, right? Of course, if it continues on, then we're in trouble.
We really are, and we've been in trouble through many Democrat presidencies. So I don't know where people get this illusion that somehow Trump is the big change. Trump is not the big change. Clinton was the big change, and that's a whole other conversation. NAFTA ruined and broke things, as
Yes.
did. Clinton is responsible, and I've written about this extensively. People can look it up. Clinton's, or I should say the Clintons, since there was a co-presidency, the Clintons are the ones who are responsible, for instance, for the, by now, I think 18 to 20 million undocumented people in this country, because they are the ones who brought about the legislative changes that made people illegal, quote unquote. So it's the legislative changes that the Clintons brought about in congruence with NAFTA and so on that has caused this massive pool of undocumented people. So that happened under a Democratic presidency, a co-presidency. And then, Obama, none of them did anything. The only, ironically, the one president who sincerely wanted to effect change on immigration was George Bush. And he was actually sincere about it. He genuinely wanted it to change for his own, whatever, you know. And since that, so, you know, having watched all of this unspool over the last few decades, I'm not filled with hope. I am just filled with a cynical desire to get people to change how they think about how change can come about. And until we get there, we're just going to keep floundering, and sinking further into this morass.
Yes, I think the need to educate yourselves, number one, and then to change your way of thinking is the only thing that can start to get us out of this mess. Yasmin, I loved our conversation. Thank you for educating me. Thank you for being so open, and just honest and truthful. It is refreshing. It really is. And I really want to thank you for your time. But before I let you go, I have one last question that I close the podcast out with. And that is, give us three resources or more to learn more about all the stuff that we've talked about today. I'm going to put your website in there because I think that is like the place to educate yourself. I mean, definitely.
For
But give
sure.
us more.
Yeah, so yes, of course, the website and my work is exactly. You know what I recommend to people in terms of learning about how the world actually operates? Start reading, and it's or at least accessing the free stuff from the Financial Times. Read the New York Times or whatever your local paper is, to keep up with the news. But if you really want to understand what the changes are, that are happening across the world, access the Financial Times that you can listen to, because the Financial Times is very expensive as a paper. It's a few hundred dollars I think in the paper form. You can act, but you can. I have a cheaper subscription. I forget how I came across it. Anyway, my point being, it's the Financial Times. It's not going to be the Guardian. It won't be the New York Times that gives you the real news, right? So what is happening financially around the world? That is what determines politics. And I think you have to keep up with that. So that's really important. I try to do that. Cut back on your consumption if you can. I understand it's great fun to scroll through TikTok and Instagram. I do this all the time. Show me, you know, a TikTok of Jason Momoa, or tell me why Blake Lively is once again angry with Justin Baldoni. That whole shebang, I know. I mean, I enjoy all of that, but you know, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think it's okay to consume all of that. I think that's the other thing I would say, which is have fun in what you consume. It's fine to do that. So in terms of resources, what I would also say is enjoy your TikToks, enjoy your IG reels, whatever, as long as you understand that they should not make up the majority of your intellectual diet, that's fine. Follow the Financial Times, you know, and yes, of course, follow me. You know, what I would also say to people is, I think social media is okay. There's a lot of backlash right now against social media. Oh, X is owned by Musk, and FB has all of these problems with Meta. Well, none of these were ever perfect. So in terms of resources, what I would say is use social media as you want, but don't think about it as the definitive source of information. But use it for whatever you need to use it for, and just keep moving on with your life. Talk to people in real life as much as you can. You know, if it means hosting a book club, if it means gathering your friends together, even on Zoom, wherever. To talk maybe once a week, you know, have a consistent time and you know, place or a Zoom conversation scheduled every month or every few weeks, whatever. I have one of those every month. You know, keep in touch with people in real life so that you're not mediating your level of anxiety constantly through social media alone, which, by the way, I should add, as someone who isn't actually out in the world even hanging out with people at parties because I refuse to go to parties. It's difficult for me, but I try constantly. I think it's really important to sustain the quality of your relationships rather than the quantity. So I, for instance, have been going through my Facebook account and just removing people. I had 3,800 people. I'm now down to like maybe 1,200 and I'm trying to reduce it. I don't know if it's going to be 50 or 500. I don't care. Facebook is no longer what it used to be years ago when it was some kind of a place where you could, share your work and so on. Anyway, the point being, I'm really working on becoming more intimately attached to the people in my life and less interested in are there thousands of people reading my work or not, which would help me, if, but only if they paid for it, which is the other issue. Anyway, resources. The other thing I will say about resources is if you are consuming work, right? Whether it is the New Yorker consistently, or if it's the New York Times consistently, or someone like me consistently, pay for the damn thing. I see people constantly boasting about how they've broken through the paywall and got the New Yorker article for free, or the New York Times, or the Chicago Sun-Times, which is free, but or the Tribune. People, this stuff costs money. The hours I spend doing research on one article, which shows up as maybe 1,500 words, you can't really count those. That's labor. The hours that a journalist, even from the hated New York Times, and I hate the New York Times for so many reasons, right? But it costs money to send a journalist out into the world on a flight with per diems, with food to keep them going. It costs money to do that, right? It costs money at Current Affairs, even though they don't have quote unquote journalists going out into the world. It costs money to edit, to ask for articles, to work with writers. Those are all things that are labor intensive. And people have to stop thinking about intellectual labor as a buffet from which they can consume vast quantities of food and only pay $10.95. Right? This is the attitude that people have right now towards media. It's like they're walking into Old Time Country Buffet and for $15.95 getting, 10 entrees and three desserts and so on, and beverages, all for that one price. It costs money. So if you need to cut down on your media consumption, bloody well do that. But do stop filching things from paywalls. Now, I will say, the first thing I will say is that I think, I have all kinds of issues with the New York Times. I think the New York Times, plagiarizes other people, journalists. There are issues. Fine. If you can justify filching the New York Times, fine, go ahead and do it. But, and I did not say that. But anyway, the point being, even something that quote unquote just looks like analysis or an opinion is work. It takes work, right? These are not I'm sorry, but these are not essays. These are not blog entries on Substack. These are pieces of art. This is work and labor. Pay for it. So when you ask about resources, the first thing I will say is, here are the resources. Pay for it. Stop boasting about breaking through a paywall. It's not cute. It's not funny. It's not liberate. It's not liberation. It's not revolutionary. You're just stealing, and you are basically justifying exploiting someone's labor, stealing someone's labor. Anyway, so that's what I will say is those are the kinds of resources. And what I would also say is, pay for me or pay for someone else. Choose someone whose work you like. Try to be very intentional. Maybe you say, this is my budget, and here is what I will pay for. I will pay for one daily paper. I hope you have a good one in your state, and I will pay for one, Substacker or blogger, whoever, or thinker, whatever, however you define them, and I will pay for this. But make decisions about that. Be intentional. Wow.
I agree. I agree. And that's how you'll get quality journalism as well, when you support
Exactly.
journalism. So it's a
Exactly. Support
circle.
your journalism, for goodness
Yes.
sake.
Right.
Stop acting like you're owed it. No one is. I have seen people share entire articles, for instance, from the Chicago Tribune and copy and paste it into comments as if they're doing something revolutionary. And it's horrible. First of all, it's illegal. This is not something you should be doing, but it's a horrible thing to do.
Yeah, on that very, very good advice. Yasmin, thank you for your time. Thank you for talking to me today, and thank you again for being so honest and just so articulate.
Thank you, Rupani, and I'm so sorry. Like I said, well, I'm not going to apologize for not
No,
being.
I don't think you
No.
should. I don't think you should. You're speaking the truth, and I love it.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for this opportunity to talk at length.
I loved it.
Thank you for listening to us today. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram at Radio Inkalab. Until next time, Abjo.